Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming back to WorldForge. WorldForge is a podcast by creators and for creators, where we use random prompts to invent just about anything you can imagine. Together, we'll make heroes and villains, ancient monsters and magical cities, and our hope is that we can inspire all the other creators and storytellers out there listening to do the same. So without any further ado, I'm Piper.
And I'm Sam.
And welcome to WorldForge.
Hello, listeners. What is up? We are back this week with another episode of WorldForge for you.
Hey.
How you doing this week, Piper?
I'm doing pretty good, Sam. How about you?
I'm great. This is another classic WorldForge intro.
Ooh. Classic in that we say hello and how are you?
Yes, exactly. Just like we do every week.
Wow, so nice.
We hope that you are all doing good this week, listeners. We've got kind of a fun one, I think, inspired by some real life experiences of ours. You know, normally we have really boring, terrible episodes.
Yeah, I'm like always trying to pinch myself to wake up and be like, oh, yeah. And then he put on a hat. I don't know.
The nightmare is over at the end of the hour long time you spend with us every week. But this week we're going to actually try. It's
going to
be a fun one, I think, for that reason.
We're actually combining kind of two ideas in this episode this week.
Yes, we are.
Because one of them we're combining is actually inspired by a real life thing that's happening to us right now. Sam and I have just started a house hunt.
Yes, exactly. If you can believe it, we do exist when we are not on air.
Yeah.
Don't just disappear into the ether.
And we also have a lot of stuff and life goals, and those things both need a house.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Hopefully we'll find one.
So we thought it would be fun to kind of talk about something that I find to be really important and fun in D&D games is, you know, oftentimes developing kind of long-term goals for your characters can be a tricky thing. And something that I always find to be really, really fun in games is to establish kind of a home base, a base of operations, whether that means my character is buying an inn or a brothel if they're kind of saucy, or just, you know, setting up a home or a castle for themselves.
Or building a spaceship.
Exactly.
You were just saying about how really excited you are about getting into Starfinder.
Yes.
And about one of the big things that you're looking forward to, which I totally agree with, surprisingly, is the idea of getting a ship and being able to modify it and make it your own, which I think would be very cool.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're going to be talking about that, establishing sort of bases of operations and sort of like little home bases here, places to launch all of your adventures from,
and to
live in and to just kind of do your thing in your downtime. I think that's kind of a fun thing to have.
And the other part of it that we're kind of combining is another idea that actually Sam kind of came up with earlier that he was saying he wanted to do is have an excuse to kind of talk about some of our past characters that we've played as in our different campaigns that we've done off air. And so the way this idea kind of came together is we said, well, what if we randomly like spun a wheel with our characters on it, and we picked one of Sam's characters and we picked one of my characters, and then we spent a little time introducing you guys to those individuals, and then we put them into sort of like an odd couple situation.
Yeah.
You know, what is their WandaVision sitcom where suddenly they have to live in a house together and one's really messy and one's a clean freak?
That's a good point. This kind of can potentially tie into WandaVision too. Let's pretend that was our plan all along.
Which we have been watching and we love.
Yes, it's really good. It's exciting so far. I think this will be fun. I think seeing what it'll be like to have some of our characters as roommates will be a fun way to, I think, learn a little bit more about those characters and put them in situations we wouldn't really see them in normally.
Yeah.
And also just to kind of give us a little bit of a break from creating something totally new. It's sort of fun to have a prompt that we're going to be really familiar with this week.
Right.
And I'm excited to see where we go with that.
I really hope that we get characters who are not from the same campaign. And if we do happen to get characters from the same campaign, I think we should roll one of them again. Because I think we've already interacted with those characters together. So it'd be really fun to take two strangers and make them live in a space.
Yeah, no, totally. I believe in the heart of the dice, and I don't think that we're going to get a bad matchup here. But if we do, we'll just cut it out and pretend it didn't happen. So,
yeah, the secret of radio.
For all you know, listeners, we got the perfect combination right from the start. But I think this will be neat. We also actually just started watching Game of Thrones again.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about noble houses in a different way, maybe that's kind of a... If we're reaching for ways to tie this into our real life experiences, I think that's fair.
There you go.
We were kind of curious to see, you know, we watched Game of Thrones from the start all the way through, and we probably feel mostly about the same as you do about the conclusion to the show. But we were just curious to see if that kind of held up again, and we decided, hey, let's watch it again. Although, also, we went to a wedding yesterday.
How is this tying in?
Well, because it's occurring to me that watching Game of Thrones, starting to watch it again right after going to a wedding is maybe a little bit, like, inappropriate because of all the terrible things that happen at weddings in Game of Thrones.
Well, that wedding already concluded, and it went great.
No one died.
Nothing to worry about. I personally wanted to go back to the show because Sam, you've told me that you have rewatched season one many times.
The first, like, three or four seasons I've seen through many times.
Because you kept showing it to friends, so you kept rewatching it. Yeah.
I was pretty cool. I kind of liked Game of Thrones before it was popular. So,
Before
it was, like, the biggest thing in the entire world.
I've seen season one a couple of times because it was the same thing. You know, I started watching it. I introduced it to a friend. But otherwise, I've only seen the show through the once as it was, like, airing live.
Yeah.
And so I am really excited to go back and revisit it. And I was saying to you while we were kind of watching these first few episodes of the first season is the first time I watched it, I had a very, like, emotional attachment to the way I was viewing everything.
Yeah.
So I was emotionally invested in all these characters and I was seeing everything new for the first time. And, you know, I get the same kind of experience when I see a movie for the first time versus when I rewatch it at home. I can kind of go back and look at it more analytically and more critically because the first time it's all about new sensations and, you know, it's like, wow, this is so amazing.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to go back now and kind of look for the little hidden connections that are revealed early on that, like, lead to other things later. Knowing the ending, I think, makes rewatching it from the beginning very, I don't know, educational. There's things you can learn about it the second or third time through.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think even outside of the story considerations, there is a lot in terms of, like, critical analysis that we can look at with Game of Thrones. I mean, you know, anything that spans the course of almost 10 years, right, is going to undergo a lot of kind of growing pains, right? There are things that in season one were kind of in the cultural sort of zeitgeist that maybe seemed really appropriate and okay to explore in a certain way in a show that by season eight, maybe we're like, ooh, yikes, they're kind of using this in an interesting way, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see sort of the social exploration of some of the things that we see in Game of Thrones now that maybe I didn't really look at in 2007 or whenever it was, that the 2008, 2009.
Totally.
It was 2010 probably actually when that show started.
Yeah.
But I think it'll be really interesting to see that again. And who knows if we'll make it all the way through. Maybe we'll get to season five and just be like, this is not good anymore. We don't want to go through this again. But.
Well, if I stay on par with how I usually like to view things, I'm not much of a binge watcher and Sam is. Oftentimes we'll, like, pick a show and Sam's like, we need to finish all five seasons in one go. And I'm like, no, we just finished season one. Now let's watch some Seinfeld. Now let's do some Breaking Bad. Not just kidding. Not that. Better Call Saul. And, like, just kind of break it up. And it's like, okay, now I can go back to this. Because, I don't know, typically with things, if I watch it all at once, it's a little too much for me and I can't appreciate it as much. Yeah. But we'll see.
I guess the point of this digression here is this is a warning to our listeners that if we start getting into that Game of Thrones shit again too heavy, that's why. we're gonna try to maybe temper our inspirations to not all just be Game of Thrones again, because we all put up with that for a decade. And I think as a people, we've moved past it, and we don't necessarily want to, you know, drudge up old wounds again.
See, I'm just treating it as research so I can make every character the Hound or Jorah Mormont.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There were a lot of characters that were done dirty that I think are worth revisiting. So, yeah. Anyway, that's our kind of little life update here. We do have some game updates, Piper. We finally got to jump into your one shot that we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks on this podcast.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you want to share? Any fun experiences? Anything that, you know, we talked a lot about your kind of creative process and some of the characters that we're putting into the world and some of the, you know, adventures and ideas that are powering this one shot. Do you have any thoughts about how that all came together and how we sort of actually realized some of these things that you are really happy with, or anything that you were kind of hoping would be a little bit more, or what would you want to share about that?
I was very happy about the first playthrough. I thought that you all did an awesome job interacting with the world. I really liked how curious you were in the way that you kind of asked questions both of the NPCs and also just for me, the DM, to know more about your setting. So that was really exciting to know that you guys were curious and invested.
Yeah.
So Melinda from Wizards and Wine, she was playing a character that actually had a lot of extensive background information from the world already. And I was very impressed by how she came up to bat and she had all these things in her pocket that she could just pull info out of. So she did a great job being honestly, sort of like an informant. It was awesome.
Melinda, bless you. Like that is honestly, that's a really hard character to play, I think, to be given all that sort of homework by your DM and to really just hit it out of the park like that. You're totally right. Like she stepped up to bat and nailed it. I am privy to a lot of information about this world just from kind of walking through it with you on air and off air.
Yeah.
But I think it's so nice as a player in the game to have someone besides the DM that can kind of answer my questions and help walk me through a space and help me sort of role, you know, facilitate good role play.
Absolutely.
And I think Melinda did a wonderful job of helping to do that.
She was fabulous. And I was saying to you guys, I think after we kind of stopped role play, we were just sort of like chatting for a bit before we kind of closed out of our video chat, is that I don't really have a guide character that I'm using, because oftentimes when I DM or when we DM, there's usually like a sort of NPC guide character that you can kind of put in case the party is lost, that they'll kind of pop in and be like, what's that over there? and I don't really have one of those for this game. And so I really appreciated that Melinda kind of stepped into that role, which was really nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I also think this is probably an interesting thing for you as well. Like running games that I'm involved in. I mean, not to be establishing a hierarchy or anything, you know, but like I've played D&D for a lot longer than you. And I'm a lot more familiar with a lot of the rules. And I think that is sort of the dynamic that we have is – I think that frees you up to tell a story. And I often feel that you kind of say, you know what, Sam, you can just help with like the dice rolls and the rules and things like that. And I really like this dynamic because I think we get better stories out of that. Mm-hmm. I like that you don't have to be sort of laden down with worrying about all of the sort of crunch of it. Right. And I'm happy to take that over because for me, the crunch is a lot of the fun, you know, and I like that we get this sort of focus on the stories that we wouldn't necessarily be able to have if you were preoccupied with worrying about, oh, is this a balanced encounter? Or is this a, you know, is this the way this particular thing kind of works? Like,
yeah,
I think it's a really fun dynamic to go back and forth with that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a valuable thing that is, it's not, I really want to be clear. This isn't me being like, Piper, you should learn the rules of D&D. Like, I think there's a lot of value to having different sources of input here your game.
I'll add on to that and say, I agree. I am definitely a storyteller first, and that's what I prioritize. And I like that in our dynamic, it's very collaborative.
Yeah.
Is that I know that I can ask you about how encounters could go, but I also know that with Mike and Melinda, I can say, hey guys, here's kind of what I'm thinking for this. How do you feel about that? And we can kind of like workshop that live in the moment. I also want to take this moment to say a quick early kind of think tank shout out to our listeners who apparently a lot of our D&D listener friends took fencing in high school, because I have had two people come and contact me. Thank you so much. Saying like giving me tips on how to do the potential fencing encounters. Very helpful, listeners. Yeah. Thank you for chiming in. I've gotten a lot of great advice on how to do that should an encounter like that come up.
You all know that research is not our strong suit, doing this work.
I've actually done so much research for this one.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of you.
Normally I don't, but
I think we often rely on you, our listeners, to come to us with that information.
It's crowdsourcing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's really helpful to say, you know, we can go to the Wikipedia page for fencing and learn about a foil and an épée and you know, all these different things. But it's nice to have someone who's actually kind of been in that world to just say, I'll give you the bird's eye level overview of this.
Yeah.
Which is way more effective of a way to learn that, I think, a lot of the time.
Well, it's funny.
That's really great.
Yeah, because it was our friend Noel, Holy Cannoli, on Twitter. He contacted me first being like, yeah, I took fencing in high school and here's some ways you could do this. And I shared that with you, Sam, and we're like, what bougie person takes fencing in high school? But then lo and behold, after the next episode, I had another person contact me and be like, I took fencing in high school and here's what you should do. So
absolutely.
I guess this is more common than we thought.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really cool to get, like you said, it's crowdsourcing these ideas. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is most valuable about this show, is that we get to hear from all of you and you get to sort of enrich our worlds in exactly the way that we hope that we enrich your worlds. You know, I mean, we want to give you ideas and give you prompts and things like that for your games. And it's really important for us to let you know that you also do that for us. You know, I think that's a really fun thing. I also, kind of touching again on the sort of dynamic that we have, saying, you know, sometimes I can help with the rules and you help with the story. Like, I think since we've started the show especially, that's really been a guiding philosophy behind how we play D&D just in general.
Yeah.
I think it's been a really nice thing that we have this sort of collaborative storytelling method, and not just between you and I, but between, you know, when I run a game, I want to hear from all of my players. I want to know, I want to say, when we walk into a room, what do you see in the room? What do you think should be here? Who do you think should be here?
Exactly.
I think those are things that can, it can, one, take a lot of the burden off of you as a DM, because you don't have to necessarily come up with everything all by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you give your players the opportunity to help you build and flesh out a world, you are also giving yourselves opportunities to kind of tell, you know, to follow different paths through the world, to tell different stories and to give your players different quests and opportunities and, you know, adventures and treasures and things like that. I think you should open your mind to the possibility that your players are just as important in the storytelling process.
100%. I was thinking about this exact thing, and I think I have a plans to give you all kind of like a homework assignment, which I think would actually be really fun.
I love it.
For one of our later games that we're going to do. So the big climax of this game is going to be leading up to, I mean, the whole week is all this kind of carnival celebration.
Yes.
And every evening of carnival, which is like a week long event, is a different house throwing a different big party. But the biggest party of the whole like week is the one that the royal family puts on the last night, right before they gather the following day to make their big vote, essentially. And so for that celebration, I wanted to give you all a homework assignment to say, I want everyone to go out and just like kind of pick a bizarrely talented act that we might see at this final celebration.
What a great idea. Yeah.
Because I've been watching a lot of Cirque du Soleil videos on YouTube, and like, I don't know, just because they've been recommended to me, and also they feel very fitting for this kind of setting. So I just keep watching them, and the performances I'm seeing are blowing my mind. And so it doesn't have to be Cirque du Soleil, but I want you all to go out and kind of find something, and I'll be like, okay, so Mike, tell us, what is the next amazing act that we're going to see tonight?
Yeah.
And you have to describe it for us, so that way I'm not just like talking at you guys constantly.
I would love that. Yeah. You know what, listeners, if you want to participate in this, reach out to us on Twitter at WorldForgePod. If you think there's some interesting thing that would be fun to run into in a mystical carnival, we would love to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool. You've got plenty of time for our next session here.
And this definitely won't happen in the next session. It'll be a couple sessions from now, but
don't tell the listeners that. They have a hand in the way our games work. That's part of the
sure. Sam, although we've spent so much time of me talking about this world, I'm really curious to hear your take on how you felt actually playing in the land and the city of Savinci. What was your take from it?
I loved it. Honestly, I thought it was really cool to see how I was curious how well balanced it would be, right? Because there's all these different sort of directions we can go in. You have the different families, the Costas, the DeLucas, and the Pacettis, right? And I know that you kind of designed each of them to appeal to, like, kind of one to appeal to Melinda, one to appeal to Mike, and one to appeal to me.
I didn't design them that way, but I'm glad that's your read of it.
Okay. Well, I feel like they kind of naturally do.
Nice.
Then. So, I found it to be, you know, this first session we met with the Pacettis, which seemed to me as though they were meant to be the family that was kind of built for Mike, our sort of performer, like, you know, he's like a juggler and a, he does sort of physical feats.
He's a sword juggler.
Yeah, exactly. I found it to be a really interesting interaction we had with them, and I feel that I learned a lot of things as Pierre Delecto that were informative to the way that I was going to continue to play the game when I met the family that was kind of that had requested my presence, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really, really fun. I thought it was nice that it seemed like no matter where we went, there was something of value for me there. It didn't seem like I was just waiting my turn to explore this other third of Savinci.
I'm glad
that was kind of designed for me. So
yeah.
I'm impressed with the way that came together. And I also am really impressed with you know, I think you provided us with enough information that we could easily jump into this world. And, you know, especially Melinda, having been a part of this city for a while, you know, she seemed to, her character knew what was going on here, right? And the way that she prompted us to kind of ask questions and to sort of dig a little bit deeper into the things you were presenting to us.
Yeah.
I think it came together really well. I think it speaks to your abilities as a DM. And I think it definitely speaks to Melinda and Mike's abilities as players to help enable each other. And I think that is the most important thing in D&D, is that you always need to be yes-ending each other. You need to be giving everyone at the table room to play. And I really love the dynamic of this group.
Awesome.
I think it's been really fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's fabulous. I'm glad to hear those takes. And I'm very,
absolutely,
very intrigued by your read of thinking that each family was designed for a person, because I did not design them that way. I built the families first, and then I said, all right, who's most likely to be summoned by them?
That's very interesting to me to hear.
Very interesting.
I do think there is also something to this kind of, you know, the rule of threes, right?
Yeah.
I think that anytime you're telling a story, to kind of have multiple stages leading up to the big climax, you need to have like three events that are all sort of informative. That's kind of the, you know, if you're telling a joke or something,
having, it's like a basic story structure.
Exactly. Having three sort of segments to it, three sort of clues that lead up to the, like, I think that's the minimum necessary number of elements to give your players enough to sort of piece things together on their own.
Yeah. Most stories, like most magic tricks, have three acts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned that from Michael Caine in The Prestige. Yeah. Absolutely.
To bring it back.
I'm very happy with how this game is turning out so far, and I'm really excited to see where it goes moving forward. So yeah, I would encourage all of our listeners to reach out to us if you think there's something that belongs in a sort of carnival, festival of lights, masquerade type event. I think it would be cool to see if we can find ways to incorporate listeners' recommendations into it. But either way, I'm really excited to see where we go with this world. It's one of the more interesting, I can tell you spent a lot of time developing one city.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is like kind of my whole goal.
Yeah.
Also, absolutely. Random fun fact, an area you probably will never encounter in this city. I did decide last minute that it definitely has an indoor magically cooled ice rink, because I have been watching a lot of videos of Olympic figure skaters, and I'm like, you know what? Maybe they'll go to the ice rink and then we can describe that.
I feel like Pierre Delecto would be really good at ice skating, because he's got like a +10 in acrobatics or something like that, but also he's got little cat claws. He can just skate around on his tippy toes.
His cat tippy toes?
Yeah, exactly.
On his jelly beans?
Yeah.
They wouldn't force him into little cat skates?
No, he sends his little claws out of his feet.
You know? Sure.
Yeah, that's the way you do it. I think maybe we should probably transition into talking about our characters here. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got two wheels.
Yeah. Two wheels that we're going to spin here.
Two wheels.
I think I will give you the first character,
okay,
Piper.
Yep.
I introduced the episode. You should introduce the spin-ins.
Yay. All right. So Sam is going to pull up a wheel of my past D&D characters that I have played as. And this begins with my very first D&D character ever. It includes characters I created for one-shots and other characters that I've been playing casually in our recent campaigns.
Yeah, and I will give you a little bit of a kind of a background information on who these characters are. So for anyone who's not familiar, I mean, we've talked about, I think, pretty much all of these characters on the air before, but we'll just give you a refresher here so that you're not having to go and do a bunch of like 20 episodes of research from our podcast. So, Piper, the character that I got for you is a favorite of mine, actually, Madame Willa DeBara.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yes. So that's interesting, because we have talked about her a lot on air. So I won't go into crazy detail.
Go into crazy detail. See what happens.
I'll do what you say. So Madame Willa DeBara is a human fighter, but I'm playing her as a vampire, even though that wasn't really added into her character details as far as like her stats go. I think maybe she got like a +2 in strength because of it.
We have been playing by different vampire roles. I think we've kind of bent a lot of, we've cut some corners of that because we didn't want to necessarily have it be that, she can't go out in the sun. And we didn't want to have it interfere with other characters quite to that level.
Yes.
So it's like a lesser effect with a lot of those things.
Exactly. Yeah. So I didn't look up any sort of vampire stats as far as like a race that someone might have created. I'm simply playing her as a human. That's how I kind of did the role. But narratively, her situation is that she is a highborn lady who was she's not supposed to be a good person. I'm going to say that up front.
No, she's, I agree.
She's a highborn lady who's kind of a wealthy snob who is married to a man that she's definitely fallen out of love with.
Yeah.
And she is...
If she ever even was in love with
him. She probably was in love with him at first, but their marriage has gone on a long time and she's fallen out of love with him. She's kind of a bad person in that sense. But so she kind of cheated on her husband a whole lot and slept around. And one of the people that she got involved with turned out to be a vampire. And she didn't realize this person was a vampire at first. And I don't think he actually used his abilities to hypnotize her. I think she just fell for him. But I think when she tells the story to people to defend herself, she claims that he hypnotized her.
That's
and
the
that spin. He right, that he stole her away. She was a loyal wife, but he took her away and made her be this awful thing. So anyway, they courted, he turned her into a vampire, and she then decided to like hunt him down and kill him because this was a big surprise to her. This is not something she wanted. And at one point she sought out a priest of some kind to help try and revert her vampirism, and he got about halfway through the reversion before something happened that he was interrupted. So Willa is now effectively kind of half vampire.
Yeah.
So the way that she goes about the world, if she does travel in daylight, but the way I've kind of designed this is that she has traveling clothes. So she's simply covered from head to toe. You can't see any part of her skin.
And lots of umbrellas. Yes. Lots of like scarves.
She has these
hoodies.
Big like hoods and large brimmed hats. And she wears these cool goggles. And if she's out in the daylight, it won't hurt her if she's wearing the clothes that she has. But otherwise, she can transform into a bat and a black dog. Mm-hmm. And she is rather ravenous at times. We've made her Hulk out a couple of times in which, you know, she has some kind of bloodlust that makes her go a little berserk. She's rather promiscuous.
Yeah.
She, one of the details that I came up for her that I really enjoy is that she's incredibly vain and she's very well dressed. But as a vampire, I have her observing all the classic vampire rules, like no garlic, no reflection.
She has to be invited into your house.
We haven't really done that, but it should be a rule. We should incorporate that into our role play next time. So because she can't see herself in the mirror, anytime she encounters an artist of some kind, she commissions them to paint her portrait or to draw her.
Yeah.
So when she travels, she has two trunks that are attached to her horse's saddle. And one trunk is like all of her beautiful clothes and costumes and jewelry. And the other trunk is just filled with pictures of herself, drawings, so that she can pull them out and look and be like, I probably still look like
it's
that.
It's this like Dorian Gray kind of thing she has going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
So I wrote her to be a fighter because I didn't want to deal with magic systems because there's still a lot of math for me that I'm not interested in. But the funny thing is that I don't have her doing a lot of like, she's a swordsman. She has a sword, but I don't have her fighting that way very often. I usually try and role play my way out of those situations and I only come into contact or combat when it's really necessary. And I work that as a sense that she is this highborn lady and she thinks it's kind of beneath her. The idea is that she went adventuring because her son wanted her out of the castle, essentially. Yeah. She's like such a, she loves her son. He's like her son and her moon.
Her son isn't a mama's boy. She's sort of a boy's mama.
Yeah. I was trying to see like how she's like the, if you get married to a Jewish boy and she's the horrible mother that you're saddled with. And so he got married and his wife is like, I can't deal with your mother. She's the worst. Please send her away. And so he encouraged his mom to be like, Mom, go out and like, you know, see the world and then come back and then you can, you know, meet your grandkids and stuff. Please do this. And so she left to give her son and his new wife some time alone.
Yeah.
So that's why she's out adventuring and how she got associated with our party.
I also think a really interesting trait of hers that I've tried to use as a DM, and this has come up at least once in combat, is that other vampires have sway over her.
Yes.
Because there is, you know, she is connected to this sort of magical, like, vampire energy. You know, I don't think we've really clearly defined how that works in this particular universe, right? This is a campaign setting that you and I have been going back and forth on. You and I have traded off sort of DM duties. This is the same setting that my fighter bard character, Renee, the frog man.
The frog.
Is in. Yes. And so we've, you know, had some sessions where you're running it and some sessions where I'm running it. And what I really, really like about Willa Dabara is that I have sort of an in with the party as a DM that anytime another vampire character rolls up, I can suddenly just snap my fingers and make combat much more interesting because she can totally lose control at just the glance of another vampire. They can immediately see this magical current that is running through her veins and know, oh, I have power over you, you know? And I think that's an interesting thing that she's kind of overcoming or trying to overcome.
Yeah.
I mean, I see that as like a story element that's kind of a big part of her eventual arc.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really like having that little switch that I can flip as a DM.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool.
Another thing I kind of like about playing her is that she's not my most evil character. I would say that's definitely the character from our evil campaign, Philo.
But she's kind of a step into it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I like that she is so corrupted because in one of our last encounters, she met this guy who was a satyr, wasn't he? Wasn't he like a big, like half goat man?
Yeah, he's a big goat man. I wouldn't say he's a satyr. I would say he's more of like a Baphomet type. He was one of the sons of Baphomet.
He was a son of Baphomet. And she met him and she was definitely instantly drawn to his power, both his physical strength and his magical abilities and also the connections that he has with his father.
Yeah.
And I think depending on how, you know, the role play would have gone maybe differently, I could definitely see Willa abandoning her party to side with someone else.
Well, she's come very close to that, I think, several times before. She doesn't really see, she's very ambivalent about the well-being of the rest of her party in a way that, you know, I think the party cares a lot more about her than she cares about them.
Yeah.
And she's in a very supportive group and she's not somebody who is, I think, very nurturing or open with her feelings.
That's the funny thing is that I agree with you partially. I feel like as we've played, she's definitely now more or less likely to abandon them as she would have at the beginning of our session.
Yes.
Or our campaign. But like, for example, I feel like she has really attached herself to our friend Haley's character.
Yeah.
Because
Katira.
Katira, because Katira is very innocent. And I think Willa is missing her son and someone to kind of be a mother for.
Yeah.
And she kind of instantly stepped into that role for Katira, although she's very sort of like a Mother Gothel where she's like, oh, you're someone I can tell what to do and you'll listen to me. But also she's like, oh, I don't really care about you.
She's definitely a very gaslighty kind of character. She cares about you when it's convenient for her and when it's on her terms, I think, is the vibe that I get.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll see how roleplay goes. I'd be very curious to see if Willa becomes a better person at the end of this game or a worse person at the end of this game.
So I guess what I want to know from you then here, in the spirit of talking about this episode, what would you say are priorities for Willa in a home base or in a, you know, in a mansion or a manor or wherever it is that she's kind of setting down roots?
Definitely needs to be someplace that's located in close to areas of importance. She doesn't want to be out in the boonies. She wants to be someplace where there are, where things are happening.
Yeah.
Wealth and stature. This place needs to look as grand as its mistress. So she would invest a lot of money if she has it into making the place aesthetically very beautiful. I think rooms full of clothes, rooms for entertaining. She's something that just matches her vanity. That's the first things that are coming to mind.
I like that, matching her vanity. I totally see that of Willa. Definitely, when I imagine her, I think all of the finest silks and clothing and, you know, that's the most important thing to her, right? She doesn't necessarily always have people in her life who love her, but she has things that she loves.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in our first episode, we were in that kind of weird haunted house almost.
Yeah.
And she got trapped in a weird mirror because she was passing through a room of mirrors and one of them showed her reflection. So she like lunged for it and it sucked her in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if she could, I think there would be very few mirrors here because she knows that she can't see herself and that's annoying. So
what an interesting parallel that, you know, someone who is so vain but cannot ever look upon themselves, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a really fun thing to get to explore as a character. Do we want to start pairing this up then with my character that I have roulette wheeled for myself?
Sam, who is your random character from one of your past games?
I have rolled for myself my sweet little DMPC that I have inserted into the first campaign you and I ever played together.
Mm-hmm.
A kindly little dwarf fighter named Urist.
Urist!
And I think a really fun thing about Urist that culturally that I established for him is that dwarven culture in this universe, dwarves don't just have like a surname or a family name by default. You have to, even if you are from like a noble family, that kind of the lineage has like a, you know, a moniker they're known by, you have to sort of earn your name through great deeds. And that's something that I really wanted to, when putting this character into this campaign, I didn't want them to just be somebody who showed up and solved problems for you. I really wanted them to have motivation on their own. And so sometimes if you guys were doing something that, you know, maybe you needed help, he might have conflicting ideals that would prevent him from just being there for you as this kind of default tacit character that, you know, that was always going to solve all your problems for you, right?
Yeah.
So, I think he had a really interesting arc early on in the game where you guys received a secret message from a noble who had been imprisoned by his brother. His brother basically faked this noble's death and locked him away in a prison, not knowing that his brother had been practicing magic for years. And, he secretly had some like minor magical abilities. He sent a message to this party and he said, "Get over here and save me, please, and I'll reward you." Mm-hmm. And Urist, you know, who was obsessed with the idea of doing these great acts out in the world, going and making his mark and making a name for himself, literally, mm-hmm. he showed up in this town, Mirabar is what it was called, and ended up helping the party free this nobleman and reinstate him to his throne. And after all, you know, he had to go and fight a bunch of, you know, like royal guards and all this stuff. And he was granted the title, the Hammer of Mirabar.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I think we ended up giving him, you know, ultimately he said, "This will be something that I can go to my people and I can say, am I worthy of earning my surname, Urist Hammerfist now?
Cute.
Will I get that? Or can we come up with some other surname for me that is befitting of the deeds that I've accomplished?"
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really fun motivation for him. I really liked the idea of getting to explore his character in a way that it didn't result in him getting treasure or wealth or anything like that. It was just about kind of his own personal identity being kind of recognized and validated. I thought that was a really fun thing.
Yeah.
And it was very satisfying for me as a DM to have what I didn't know if this was going to be a character that resonated with you guys that you thought was going to be really important. And I got to sort of play in this world a little bit with you guys. And it gave me a really nice window into your sort of role play experience that could persist beyond just having, you know, shopkeepers and quest givers and things like that.
Yeah. I'm actually kind of glad that Urist came up for you because I feel like of all of the characters you've played as, he's the one I am least familiar with.
That's so funny because we've played him for like 5 years. He's the character we've played for the longest.
Well, I know, yeah. But I rarely ever think of Urist when I think of that party because
that would make him really sad. don't tell Urist that.
No, it's just I feel like because, Sam, you're so often, when we go on quests in that session or in that campaign, you're often like, you know, you have to juggle a lot of NPCs. Yeah. You have other characters that you're kind of giving us to interact with. And sometimes Urist...
There are a lot of NPCs in this game.
And sometimes Urist will fall to the wayside because of that, because you're prioritizing, in being these villains or these people who are quest givers or these other kind of tag-along guides that we'll meet. And sometimes we won't hear from Urist, I feel like, for a full session. And so I feel like you telling that story just now about Urist, all that was coming back to me. I couldn't recited that quest for you, but now you're saying it. I'm like, oh yeah, I do remember that happened for him. That's so nice for him. But like, I had forgotten it, so I'm excited to rediscover Urist.
Good for you, Urist. You go, Urist.
Yeah.
Right? You get it, Urist.
And none for Baphomet. Bye.
Yeah. That's so funny. I want Urist to be a memorable character, right? But at the same time, the purpose of him really mechanically is to be someone that I can, you know, if I'm not sure if something is balanced appropriately, I can put Urist into a situation or leave him out of a situation and give myself a little bit of leeway in terms of, you guys need another fighter to help out with this, or you guys are a little too strong for this scenario. Like, I'll leave him behind. He's got other things to deal with. So that's actually really cool to me to hear that he can come and go and it's, you know, you're, oh yeah, like fun, Urist, I remember him now. Or he can kind of disappear like the wind and it's not going to totally break the game.
I think the things that stand out to me about Urist the most is there are a couple of sessions where we were dealing with like a poisoned swamp, essentially. And the water was very high and we had to describe Adam's character, Brixley.
Yeah, Brixley, who was a tall lizard man.
He had to carry Urist around in a little papoose so that he didn't drown in the swamp. And I drew many pictures of it.
Yes, absolutely. Poor Urist was just like barely eyes above the water in this horrible poison swamp and had to be backpacked around by this giant lizard man. So, okay, I'll find some pictures. I've been wanting to post some pictures from this campaign for a while on Twitter, so I'll see if I can find something to share that you all can learn to love Urist in the way that we do.
Yeah. So Sam, you asked me what were some of the initial things that would have to be present in Willa's home base. What is something that Urist would have to have in his?
Well, I mean, definitely building a name for himself and kind of establishing sort of a prestige and, you know, having his reputation run before him are very important things for Urist, right? His whole life has kind of been built around that. Born into, you know, a noble family, but also at the same time kind of born into nothing. He really wants to memorialize all of these great deeds that he's done. So I think for Urist, it's really important to have like a trophy room where all of the, you know, the great deeds that he's done are laid out for his guests to see. So he would need to have like a great hall where you walk in and you see, oh, the, you know, the head of a great elk that he killed with his bare hands, and, you know, a tapestry depicting this fight that he had with a great demon or things like that would be really, really important to him.
I think that's something they would actually bond over a whole lot.
Yeah.
Because I was just thinking, I mean, they both come from noble backgrounds. And also, I think Willa would definitely relate with this idea of our accomplishments must be celebrated.
Oh, for sure.
Yes. You sure. Hang the heads of your beasts on the wall. I will hang all of my trophies that I've won for best ball of the year award or whatever. Maybe even that's, because I was going to ask you, should we come up with why these two are living together? Or should it just be stated and we move on from there?
I mean, honestly, I think an easy way to do it is they both have very performative personalities. They mm-hmm. both need to be recognized
yes,
for things, right?
Yes.
And I think, you know, maybe in the same way as, you know, when you get a bunch of like YouTube influencers who buy a mansion in LA together and they live together and say, oh, we're all going to produce a bunch of YouTube videos and we're all going to help each other out. Like, I think that would be kind of the fantasy equivalent. It would be whatever the fantasy version of that is. They would say, you know, you're kind of making a name for yourself and I'm kind of making a name for yourself.
If we unite our names.
Yeah, exactly. This brand synergy.
I love it. I was just going to say, I can see if we jump way in the future from where we're playing your Urist in our current campaign, and he's now accomplished adventurer. If Willa met him at a party, she would love to like attach herself to him.
Oh, totally.
And be
totally.
Like, ooh, yes, hello, you talented and wealthy dwarf.
Yeah.
Like, let's build a castle together, well, baby, you know, if you know
a,
what I mean.
He's a handsome guy. He's yeah. good at being the face of a brand.
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely see her going in on a castle with him for that reason.
Yeah. I like that a lot. I like that. I think it's interesting the idea of them just trying to build the fanciest, most ridiculous, over the top. You know, it's like those places in California where it's like a hotel you go to that's designed for influencers where
oh.
you go and you take a million selfies. They just have like weird rooms.
It's like a selfie museum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, here's a chair that's made of pineapples and you just take a picture here and nobody will ever have had that interesting of a selfie before. Like, I think that's kind of what they're trying to build is just this really over the top elaborate room where anybody can go there and take a picture in front of this great stag's head and be like, yo, I killed this guy, or, you know, take a picture in front of a room full of gold coins and be like, oh man, this is just like my most recent paycheck. Like, just, you know, whatever, making money, hashtag getting paid. Like, I think that would be kind of the thing that they would try to do is help each other grow their brand by creating sort of a space for other people to come in and maybe like leech off of them a little bit almost. I don't know.
I guess, yeah. I don't see though them being like, you can claim this head as yours because it's ours. I think they'd be very possessive of their own accomplishments.
Certainly.
It would be more, I think, a platform for them to, because this is in our fantasy setting and without having the access of technology and social media, if you can't take pictures of something and send it out to the world, you invite the world into your home. To
yes.
say, come
yes.
and see how great we are, and then leave and tell people how great we are. So
yes, you're right.
This yeah. would be their platform to say, I think they'd just be hosting parties and hunts and all kinds of events to say, come and see our greatness, and then tell everyone that you had a great time.
I like it. Okay,
yeah.
So let's talk specifics then, Piper. What things from our games, either with Urist or with Willa, do you think would make really interesting sort of centerpieces? Like, what types of rooms should be in this manor and what types of things would be in those rooms? Is there anything that stands out to you? You know, whether it's the, you know, the elk with the mossy antlers that you turned into a healing staff for our cleric in that game, or, you know, anything like that that should be the focus of this kind of unholy union of fantasy influencers?
Yeah, I feel like, As far as from gameplay, though, I don't know. I need to think about that. There would maybe be a jar on display that has the dragon's tear in it that Willow received from the high water dragon whom they helped. She like gave a tear to each of our party members. It's like incredible healing powers of some sort.
I like that.
So that would be in a vase on display someplace. We haven't really accomplished as much yet in Willa's campaign that I can like talk about for trophies.
Yeah, I mean, I that's a good point. We've gone through a lot of sort of trials in that campaign, but we haven't really concluded a lot of things yet. So we haven't come across a lot of, you know, great, wondrous treasures. I think in Orist's campaign, at the time when I started that, I was really focused on the idea of having a game where crafting and item creation and you know, like improving the weapons that you had was a really big focus of mine, you know? Every time we went out anywhere, I was like, oh, here's, you know, 15 specific types of gem of different sizes and values that you found.
Yeah.
And if you want to turn them into a ring or a necklace or put them on a headdress or put them on your armor or a sword or whatever, you can do that. And that was something that was really, really exciting for me. And you guys put together this whole like treasure room that, you know, you hoarded all of this wealth in that room and you could pick anything from it and use it to enhance something that you had done. So I think for Urist, it would very naturally be, there would be a room that is kind of like a museum where you have all of these resources that you've gathered from your travels, but they would be on display somewhere that any one of them you could take at any time and bring to your blacksmith and say, put this on a sword for me and it'll do, you know, +5 fire damage every time I take a, you know, swing at somebody.
Yeah.
But at the same time, until you do that, it's sitting on this little pedestal for everyone to come and be in awe of as they visit your home.
The way I view Willa's materialism, I don't see her necessarily like investing in rooms that she's going to go back to constantly to say, like, this is my room of such and such. Yeah. I think she is very concerned about staying on like trend with like kind of what's new and what's popular and fashionable. And so I see her, I'm kind of getting inspired by in Over the Garden Wall where we have Endicott Manor, which it's just, he's constantly adding to it. And I think that's something that she would be doing as soon as she finishes a grand ballroom in which they brought in like the greatest craftsmen to build it. She'd be like, I should have one party in it. And then she's like, well, you know, Lady Susan just recently got an indoor swimming pool. So I have to have one that's twice is big, so we're starting construction on that next week.
I do love the idea that, you know, anytime anything happens in your campaign, it would be reflected in this manner. You know, you'd go on an adventure in some cave and you'd kill some dragon. You'd be like, yo, that dragon had some dope torches in his cave. We got to get the best torches of all time.
Exactly. I'm investing a fortune in sconces. Yeah,
for sure. I think that'd be a fun thing. I think that'd be an interesting, it's interesting for the players in the DM because the DM can kind of create bigger and crazier and more extravagant things in the dungeons you go and explore and in the adventures that you participate in. And the players can then take that and say, ooh, how can we turn this into a fun thing for our home base, right?
Yeah.
I also do like the Endicott approach where, you know, kind of the conclusion of that story in Over the Garden Wall, if we haven't talked about this enough times on the podcast, is that it's these two super rich characters that they build these huge, massive manors that are, they're so big, they eventually connect together.
Right.
And they don't even realize that they're wandering the halls of each other's mansions because they're so rich and foppish that they think they're in their own castle when they don't even know that they're wandering around in their bitter rivals, you know, place. And that would be a really fun source for a dungeon, I think, is this castle that two different factions started building out this castle and something weird is starting to happen. They have no idea why they're seeing, you know, ghosts and monsters and random people wandering through the halls of their location because it's just connected with their neighbor and they don't even realize, you know, they're so preoccupied with their own wealth and they can't see the forest for the trees. You know?
Exactly.
I think that would be a really fun thing to explore and how your party approaches solving that problem. Do you say, well, yeah, you know, we just wipe out everybody in the other castle or we try to reach a parlay where
we live peacefully?
Yeah, exactly. Can we peacefully coexist? I think that would be a really fun thing to look into.
Speaking of peacefully coexisting, one thing I'm wondering is about our two characters' lifestyles.
Yeah.
Because I see Willa continuing with her rather promiscuous love affairs. Do you think Urist would mind that she's bringing lovers back to their castle? Or do you think he would ask her, be like, just keep this in the West Wing. I don't want to really know about it. Or does he not care? Or is she and him, are they lovers? Are they like banging it out? And so she doesn't need to bring anyone else back to the castle.
I think Urist is a lot more conservative.
I see him
than,
that way too.
Than Willa is, but I also think he is somebody who, I think Urist is a lot more conservative than Willa is, but I also think that Urist is someone who is very supportive. And I mean, that I literally designed him to be a support character, right? Like the whole point of him is that he is there to kind of help you when it's needed. And he grew into this bigger character than that. So I would definitely see him as someone who is like kind of the ultimate roommate. You know, he always does the dishes.
He's
a good wingman. Yeah, exactly. He's always there helping you out and kind of cleaning up after you a little bit. I could see him taking sort of a secondary role to Willa and being like, oh yeah, you got some guy coming up? Yeah, you know, let me make sure that everything, all the tapestries are, you know, dusted and all the sconces are lit and all, you know, we've got the bright atmosphere for you and we've got the best food available for you. I know people over in my, you know, my dwarven kingdom, we can ship in dwarven mead that you've never seen before, never tasted before. I think that would be kind of their relationship is, I almost would see Willa sometimes forgetting that he's not like a butler. I think that would be kind of like a funny thing that Willa would be like, oh, well, you know, Urist, go and, oh, Urist, could you please help with this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like she sometimes would maybe go a little too far, kind of taking advantage of his hospitality or his supportive nature.
I was actually just thinking about that, his supportive nature. And I don't want her to just be like a total bitch to this guy that she lives with. Because I always want to like try and put like a kind of like sensitive and like positive like swing onto like a character of her type like
this. But
this
is how she treats everyone in our party, kind of.
It is. But so like in this scenario, she's living with this dwarf. They're both very intent on kind of earning their nobility and proving their nobility.
Certainly.
And so I think that's something they bond over and they support each other over. But also I feel as if after all this time living with one another, they obviously, as is kind of natural to happen, you come to learn, you know, this kind of private side of someone.
Yeah.
And so I like the idea too that I think the castle should have like a west wing and an east wing, but there's a sort of this area in the middle where every now and then
no man's land.
No, where they come together and this is kind of where they're vulnerable and open with one another. And maybe Urist and Willa, maybe they're the only two people that they can kind of be open with. Maybe for everyone else, they have this persona, right? But there is a kind of openness between the two of them.
Yeah.
So I like the idea because in my mind, no character is simply just like, oh, I'm sleeping around and it's great and I love it and it's fabulous. Woo! Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I feel like Willa is searching for something. Like, why does she do that? Why does she act that way?
There's a reason that everyone does what they do.
Right, exactly. And so maybe sometime there's like a scene where there's like a room in the middle of the mansion where it's just like a big fireplace and these couches in front of it. And they can kind of sit there and maybe she's there and she has her makeup off and she's just kind of tired and sitting and she comes over and he kind of asks her what's going on and they just have nice conversations or something and she like talks and opens up to him. So I just think that's nice. And
yeah, I really like a lot that both of these characters have in a lot of ways very similar motivations. I mean, they have very similar goals, right? The things that they want out of life, to kind of be recognized and to live in this life of luxury and to earn that on their own. I think that's really interesting. And especially because they both approach it in sort of different ways.
Right.
You know, I like that a lot. And they could sort of both grow because they could learn from each other. You know, they could sort of see, oh, I see how you go about this and I see how I go about this. And am I doing it the right way? Are you doing it the right way? Is there a right way? Can we both become better through helping each other to achieve this greater thing?
Yeah.
That's really, really fun to me.
I like it too, because I'm not sure how Urist would actually respond to this kind of feedback, but when Willa hears his story of him having to earn his surname and get this respect that I think she shares this with him, maybe this idea of, well, you're born into this. Like, why do you have to fight for it? Why do you have to prove this? Like, it should just be something that's given to you because you are an equal to them. And so I think she would hear his story and say, well, I think you're a noble from the start, and you don't have to prove that to anybody, but I understand why you do, and I think you're every bit a noble, and I'll give you a surname, and it's Friend. I don't know, something like that.
I mean, I like that, because, you know, Urist's perspective is certainly that you know, I can be born with a surname, but it means nothing until I take it for myself, mm-hmm. right? And to have somebody give something to him, which maybe is not something he's really ever experienced, would be meaningful to him.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really great. And I actually think that's a really sweet sort of final note for this.
Yeah.
I like that a lot, that they would start to see in each other who they really are and see past this kind of superficial desire that they both have to be recognized by the world and to be, to have this like luxury and this sort of story they tell about themselves. Right.
Yeah.
That's really fun and not something I would have necessarily expected from either of these characters. I actually think this is a really fun exploration of both of them.
I agree, because yeah. I like the idea that they would kind of come to this conclusion that they say to the outside world, we are the best of the best and we're fabulous and we're great and everyone needs to know that. But yeah. when we're here at our castle alone and it's just us, we don't have to be the best and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because we're friends and we have an awesome house and it's full of all the things that we like, including our best buddy.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I think that's really good. I love this, actually. I wish they were in the same campaign now, honestly. I think this is really fun. Maybe I can find a way to incorporate some dear old friend of Urist's that he hadn't thought about in many years
Aww.
Into an upcoming campaign, or, you know, or we can do that with Willa or something. That would be very fun.
Cool.
But I think for now, let's just set this free, you know.
Hooray.
Let this story live on its own organically. If you listeners have any thoughts about either of these characters, if you want to find ways to use them in your worlds or find ways to you know, prompt anything you have going on in your games based on these characters, we'd love to hear about it. And you can reach out to us and share those things. Where, Piper?
On Twitter at WorldForgePod at Twitter and via email worldforgepod@gmail.com.
Yes, absolutely. We love hearing all of your feedback about mm-hmm. all of our creations and any ideas you have for future topics or, you know, episode ideas, things like that. It's very, very fun for us to hear that. So please consider sharing that with us. And I think now is time for us to jump on over to the next room in the podcast, the rec room.
The recreation room.
Yes, I've got a couple of recommendations this week for us. So talking about houses, originally, I wanted to sort of share some, you know, literal physical houses that you could build in your games. We talked last week about Studson Studios, one of my favorite new like miniature modeling and terrain building YouTube channels. And mm-hmm. They've done some really incredible stuff that I think they're very funny, and they've done some wonderful kind of silly little projects that maybe aren't necessarily broadly applicable to all of your games, but they can teach you a lot of really great things about the modeling community. And I think what is maybe a little bit more appropriate to talk about in an episode where we're talking about building houses and home bases are some of the other creators that are out there in the miniatures and terrain modeling community. So I would definitely recommend you go and look up the Tabletop Crafters Guild. They have a Facebook page. They have, I'm pretty sure, a Reddit thread. They're pretty active on Twitter. Anywhere that you are, you know, active on social media, the Tabletop Crafters Guild has a pretty solid presence. And there are a few creators that are really, really big in that community, but especially I love among them is Black Magic Craft, who I think I've probably talked about on the podcast before.
Maybe.
But Black Magic Craft is just such an incredible resource for all kinds of different techniques on how to build, you know, your own buildings and, you know, terrain and dungeons and your own little miniatures, how to modify miniatures and how to take just trash that you have lying around and use it to add on to, you know, things that you would build out of whatever, you know. If you have a bunch of little bones minis or something and you want to add on to those, they've got tutorials on how to do that. And just, it's a great source of ideas. You know, if you're a creative person on your own and you don't even need help with the techniques, you can look at those just for ideas for what to build next. And I think it's a really, really great resource. They're a really positive force in the community, and I think a great place to look for just something new to do. And you can build adventures out of the things that you build. You don't even have to have an adventure in mind when you're building something. And I think that's really, really nice.
Yeah.
So that is, again, the Tabletop Crafters Guild and especially Black Magic Craft. I also would say something that's been really helpful for me when thinking about, you know, trying to build castles and homes and, you know, inns and just, you know, bases of operations, I really like to sometimes just mess around in Minecraft or a game where you have kind of the freedom to build.
Sims.
Yeah, exactly. The Sims or Minecraft or, you know, any game where you have, you know, Skyrim gives you the ability to build your own home in one of the expansions, in the Hearthfire expansion.
Animal Crossing.
Animal Crossing is a wonderful example. I played EverQuest 1 and 2 for like 10 years, and one of my favorite things in either of those games was the player housing system in there, where in EverQuest 2 especially, there was a whole line of quests where when you completed them, it just gave you furniture to put in your house. It gave you like, you know, plushies of all the different monsters you can kill and all of the different weapons you can get and things like that. I think that's a really, really fun thing. So any game or, you know, role play system or, you know, adventure module or anything like that where you can have some type of exploration of a thing you can build, see if you can find a way to convert that into a D&D adventure. I think that's really fun. YouTube channels I would recommend if you want to look into like Minecraft stuff. Mumbo Jumbo is a great channel. He's huge. Nobody needs to be recommended Mumbo Jumbo. Fire UK, that's F-Y-R-E UK, was a really, really cool channel that I used to watch a few years ago that they do speed builds of these huge, epic, massive buildings in Minecraft. And they'll take, you know, a 2 month long build and condense it down to a 3 minute video where you can just see 50 people just go into town in creative mode. And a lot of stuff they do is really neat. And a third one would be B00100, who does a really good job of kind of talking through his creative process and explaining why he builds, you know, a blacksmith and an inn and a hotel and all these different things in his Minecraft worlds. I think those can be really great places to look for inspiration for your games, because it lets us talk about, you know, why are all of these different pieces in place? You know, why do we need a treasure room, and why do we need a weapons room, and why do we need a stable, and all these different things?
Yeah.
Those are very, very fun. I recommend you check out any of those.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And then quick, kind of bringing it back to Think Tank, kind of mentioned this earlier, but I didn't say one of the wonderful fencing recommendations that we received. So a big thank you this week goes to Ed Does Everything on Twitter.
Yes, thank you, Ed.
At Ed Does Everything. And then also Holy Cannoli, who helped me a great deal with the how to do the mechanics of fencing in roleplay. So thank you to both of you, fencing maestros.
All of our extremely classy, bougie friends who...
or big nerds.
Yeah.
Toss of the hat. Who knows which
one? Yeah, nobody knows. Yeah. On a Sunday, you're a nerd. On a Monday, you're bougie. Who knows? We really, really appreciate your input, as we appreciate the input of all of our listeners. So again, please consider reaching out to us on Twitter at WorldForgePod, at Gmail, WorldForgePod@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. And
consider leaving a review.
Yes. Thank you, Pepper. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I did. It's the best way to support us and get us in front of other people. It helps recommend our podcast to other people if you don't want to do it yourself. but yeah, that is a big help. And we really appreciate when you let us know that you like what we do.
It really means a lot. So we will leave you with all those thoughts, I think, this week. We hope that this has been a great source of inspiration for you. And we look forward to being back here for you again next week with another very exciting topic.
Absolutely.
Yes, we love you all, listeners. We hope you have a great week, and goodbye.
And goodbye.